Join us as we listen closely to voices that still echo from our nation's past. Distant, even obscure, but all the more exciting for that mystery. It's where fascinating women discuss fascinating women's histories. I'm Tzipora Weinberg, and this is Veiled Reference. Let's take a deep dive into pockets of history preserved in our Torah sources. With each episode, we'll travel back in time to discover and recover stories of women who might have otherwise been lost to us. Piecing together the tales of these women of old can help us to understand periods of time that we've only hazily conceived of before. It's time to let these women's voices rise to the surface through the sources left to us, and to learn about the lives they led, and maybe draw inspiration and strength to empower each one of us on our own journeys. And so it's absolutely appropriate to begin our quest with a remarkable woman. Doña Gracia Mendez Nasi is nothing short of exceptional. Despite being born into a tumultuous time in Jewish history, she ascended to tremendous power. I think it's fair to say she was the most effective woman, the woman who intervened, supported, and accomplished the most for the Jewish people since biblical times. We learn about her through our rabbinic sources. She appears in the writings of the Maharashtam, the Mahari Ben Lev, and others. And historians draw upon these sources to document her unusual life as she ascended to the position of the most wealthy and influential woman in the free world at the time. Joining me today, I have the distinct pleasure and honor of welcoming an exceptional woman in her own right, Miriam Wialgis. Without irony, I say Miriam's the woman most likely to be a superhero of all the women that I know. Alongside her life as a master educator of history, she's such an inspirational mother, daughter, grandmother, and friend. I'm so proud and excited to introduce you, Miriam.
Thank you so much, Tzipora. It's a pleasure to be here. I think it's only fair for our listeners to know something about you, Tzipora, since you are the host of this podcast and you're too modest to talk about yourself, so I will. I'd like to just tell listeners that several years ago, I got a phone call from my son, who lives in North Woodmere, and his shul, a lovely congregation called Leib Avos, was looking for a rav. And after many testings of many different rabbinic candidates, my son calls me and says, Ima, we have an amazing new rav, but I got to tell you, the Rebbetzin, you're going to love. I think she's an academic, Jewish history. So sure enough, next time we went to North Woodmere, I went to shul and I met the incredible Tzipora Weinberg, who is a descendant of a very illustrious Hasidic dynasty, who is the wife of an incredibly brilliant Hasidic Rebbe in Woodmere, Long Island. And she is herself a scholar in her own right. She is a graduate student in Jewish history. She is currently the recipient of a fellowship at YIVO. She is also a current fellow at the Center for Jewish History. She is also, for readers of the Mishpacha, the author of that incredibly moving and powerful article that appeared last summer on the last Ne'ilah of Tells, which was so beautiful. I think I cried through the whole thing and I got so many phone calls. Do you know the Tzipora Weinberg? She's incredible. She's also an expert on the famous composer Yom Tov Erlich, and she's published and written about him. And it is certainly such a pleasure to be here with you, Tzipora, and I am so lucky to count you as a friend. And I have to say that I love going to shul. I don't always go to shul in Yantif, but now I do. When I'm in Woodmere with my kids, I go to shul and we talk shop. So it's so lovely to be talking shop in a more formal setting. And thank you so much, Tzipora.
I have to recover from that a little bit, but that was so kind and way, way generous of you. Thank you so much, Miriam, for those beautiful words. It's true that we are opening this forum, opening this podcast to highlight amazing women. And it's so fitting that we begin with you. So now tell us a little bit about yourself and your life as an educator and your particular area of expertise and specialty.
Okay, so I am currently the chair of Jewish history at the Joel Braverman Yeshiva High School, Yeshiva of Flatbush High School in Brooklyn, New York. Prior to that, I taught European history at Touro College, as well as Jewish history at several high schools around the tri-state area. Despite the fact that I'm Ashkenaz, or maybe because I'm Ashkenaz and the grass is always greener on the other side of the ethnic divide, I've always had a fascination for Sephardic history. It's one of the subjects I teach at Flatbush, and Flatbush, some listeners might know, is primarily Sephardic these days. At a certain point, I was so engrossed with the teaching of Sephardic history, and my students just assumed that I was Sephardic, and I started to believe that I must have some Sephardic ancestry, because there's something about the culture, the history, the music, the food that I absolutely adore. On a comical note, my own kids got me the Ancestry.com test kit, and I was so convinced that I would find that I was at least 5% or 10% Sephardic. To my horror and dismay, it turns out that I was 100% Ashkenaz, but nevertheless, the fascination with Sephardic history continues. I, at this point, consider myself, after 25 years at Flatbush, a sort of honorary member of the Sephardic community. But in any case, I love that we're starting off with the story of Donna Gracia. And Donna Gracia's story is so incredible for many reasons, but it's also part of a larger story that's been happening in the study of Jewish history. And that is, you know, we always say that history is written by the winners. And the truth is that in the modern period, we Ashkenazim were the dominant group. We had the numbers, we had the influence. And so it's no surprise that when you look at books that were written about Jewish history, Sephardim tended to be downplayed. And if you highlighted them at all, it was only about the medieval period when you had the Golden Age. And what's been happening the last 20, 30 years is that you've had a renaissance of Sephardic studies. The Sephardic community is growing, coming into its own. And the Donna Gracia story is really part of this larger rediscovery of the Sephardic history and heritage. And it's just very exciting to be part of that story. Just to give you an example of what we mean, for years I taught a college-level survey of modern Jewish history, and Sephardic history was ignored. Well, about 10 years ago, we added a unit on Sephardic history. And today I would say that Sephardic history is one of the most exciting fields of Jewish historiography. So this is really part of this project to reclaim Sephardic history. And it's so wonderful that you're talking about Donna Gracia in particular.
I love that we are doing a reclamation of Sephardic Jewish history alongside a reclamation of women's history, because that too, similarly, just as the Sephardic Jews have been marginalized, women's studies have been marginalized. And to take women front and center, which is what we'll be doing in this podcast, and to be bringing their voices back to life, fuses so beautifully with what you were talking about in terms of re-centralizing Sephardic Jewry. And I think one of the reasons Donna Gracia is amazing to begin with in terms of Sephardic Jewry is because when we think about the Inquisition, the skeleton, the bare bones sketch is what most easily comes to mind. Jews were kicked out of Spain in 1492 if they hadn't converted to Christianity. But the lead into that, as you're suggesting about Sephardic Jewish history, in fact, was far more complex. The center of Jewish life in the medieval period, the hub of the Jews, was Muslim Spain. And the history of Al-Andalus, Jews under Muslim rule, was a time of flowering and growth, a flourishing forth that yielded advancements and innovations in Torah, in Jewish philosophy, piyut, diktok, grammar, in Lashon Kodesh poetry. And that's why it was called the Golden Age of Jewish Spain. But then, with the dissolution of the caliphate and the Reconquista, Christianity comes to Spain. And that's where our story begins.
I love how you're pointing out that 1492 is just really the end of the story that begins earlier. And it's fascinating when I ask my students, what's the number one date you need to know in Sephardic history? It was 1492. But then we learned that 1492 really began in 1391. Ever since the Christians had lost Spain to the Muslims in 711, they were undertaking this 700-plus year-long crusade to win back Spain. And by 1391, much of Spain was under the control of Christians. And with that comes a growing anti-Semitism. And in 1391, a terrible event takes place. You have pogroms, riots against the Jews that break out in Seville and then spread to nearby towns and villages. So 1391 marks the beginning of severe persecution of the Jews in Spain. And we need to understand that church law says that any Jew who's converted by force, even by force, is now Christian forever. And it doesn't matter if they want to revert back to their Judaism, they can't. The problem is that in 1391, thousands of Jews were forcibly converted. Many of them have no intention of living as Christians. So for the next 100 years, they and their descendants will be living as secret Jews. The terms we use are interesting. Many listeners might know the term Marranos, which is a problematic term. It might mean, it's not clear in the sources, it might mean swine or pig. Mary. We also have the term anusim, those who are forced. We have the neutral term new Christians. We have the term conversos, which is the term that we'll use for the rest of this podcast, the conversos, those who are converted. And the question is, what will the church do with these conversos who they suspect of keeping Judaism secretly? And in doing so, you are now, according to church law, a heretic. But this scenario is crazy. You are going to have, for a century, Jews living side by side, those Jews who were never converted, living side by side with friends, relatives, neighbors who had been converted, many of whom would like to hang on to their Judaism. And who was helping them retain their Jewish ties? The Jews who had never been converted. And this is the single most important reason why the Jews, you mentioned 1492 as the pivotal year in Sephardic history, why were Jews given this terrible choice of expulsion or conversion? Well, the expulsion decree, the Alhambra decree, spells it out. Ferdinand and Isabella were not just garden variety anti-Semites who wanted to get rid of the Jews in order to create one fully Catholic kingdom, but as Ferdinand and Isabella wrote in their expulsion decree, we're getting rid of the Jews because those Jews who are open Jews, never converted, are helping the converso stay connected to Judaism. And that was the entire, really, the reason given for the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. And that means that the Jews now, who are fully Jewish and were never converted, now have a choice. Do they stay and convert, or do they leave and remain Jewish?
That's a tremendously helpful insight, because we tend to think, when we think about that period of time, that every Jew converted. And I think that's a point we have to underscore. We think of people living in the closet, everyone's living as secret Jews, but in fact, that wasn't the case. If you didn't attest to Christian faith at the time, if you were not baptized, you were able to practice as a Jew until that time came that it became forbidden, which is what Ferdinand and Isabella facilitated. I wouldn't even say facilitated, I would say enforced, right? They demanded. Now, this definitely complicates the picture and expresses the tragedy of choice that Jews faced at the time. Choice in air quotes. We've all heard the stories of those who ran away and those women who stayed and lit candles in a pot on Friday nights, right? How many camp cantatas in the 9 days recalled that secrecy, all the songs we used to sing about keeping your Jewishness secret and quiet and the sadness of not being able to show evidence of Yiddishkeit within your own home. But there have been very exciting historiographical interventions of late about this. Benzio Netanyahu, Bibi Netanyahu's father, who spoke about how deeply the racial implications of this kind of anti-Semitism, anti-Judaism, and specifically the idea of purity of blood, which was the initial law that was enacted called Limpieza de Sangre, about the suspicion of impure blood being a reason to marginalize Jewish people, being a precursor to the Nuremberg laws. So that's something that we can really trace back to the 1492 Alhambra decrees and understand where these are actually coming from. What was the motivation behind these racialized laws against the Jewish people that supposedly were about Christian faith, but perhaps, as Netanyahu suggests, were about something much deeper?
Right. The big question in, as you mentioned, the myth that all Muranos since 1391 and then again up to 1492, there's this sort of mythology that they're all secret Jews. What Netanyahu did very controversially in his book, The Origins of the Inquisition, is that he completely rejected this theory. And he said, in fact, most of the conversos would have been totally happy to assimilate and move up the ranks in Christian society. And that we tend to exaggerate just how closely connected these conversos were, certainly after one or two generations when it's hard to stay connected to Judaism. You were exaggerating the extent to which they were connected to Jewish life and law and ritual, and that many of them, had the church left them alone, would have easily assimilated into Christian society. And what he says is, controversially, is that because you have this intense hatred of the Jewish people and also economic jealousy, because let's not forget, and this is so important in our discussion of Dona Gracia, if you're a converso, you now have business opportunities, social opportunities. You can become very wealthy and very powerful as a converso. You're now a new Christian. And so coupled with this animosity towards Jews that has, as you say, a racial component plus economic jealousy, the church does something that is astonishing. They have won the battle for the first time in Jewish history. What has Christianity always wanted? To convert Jews. We have never converted in large numbers until 1391 and then again in 1492. Now the church comes along and says, we don't trust you. In fact, they're going to create an organization called the Inquisition, which is a religious court trial. We're going to see if we suspect you of secret Judaizing tendencies, we're going to arrest you, torture you, and ultimately perhaps burn you at the stake. And what the church is saying is, we don't care if you're Christian and you're professing the Christian faith, we don't trust you. And Netanyahu is suggesting that a lot of these accusations were false. And what the church is doing now is revealing its racial animus and hostility of Jews. And Netanyahu, the historian, this colors his whole view of the era. And he says exactly that. This is racial anti-Semitism. You mentioned the Nuremberg laws. The Limpieza de Sangre, the laws that the Inquisition is going to bring, or the laws that the government is going to bring, which say, just to clarify for our listeners, these are blood purity laws that say, if 100 years after a Jew converted, his descendants who are Christians apply for a job in the bureaucracy, guess what? They're not going to get it because we're going to open up these books of records that were kept, blood purity laws. Your great-great-great-great-grandfather was a Jew, a convert, and therefore you can't get this job. What does this tell you? Netanyahu clarifies. He says, this means that you have this bitter, deep racial hatred that cannot simply be explained by Christian anti-Semitism. And this is astonishing because if Netanyahu is right, He is suggesting that the presence of racial antisemitism goes way back. And he sees this, by the way, as extending past the Inquisition to earlier eras. It's the halacha b'yadua she'esav sonei le'yakov. There's this racial antisem that exists throughout history. And by the way, you mentioned he's Bibi Netanyahu's father. This is astonishing. There have been historians and scholars who say that Bibi Netanyahu's right-wing, hawkish views on everything from Iran to Israel security stems from his father's perception of history as an us against them. And there's this animus and hatred built in that we need to acknowledge, and we can't be optimistic, so to speak, about relationship between non-Jews and Jews. We need to determine there's this hatred out there and deal with it in a strong and firm manner.
Well, what it particularly does is upends the notion, that Christian notion, that once we do convert, Jews would be fully accepted no matter what. If generations later, the limpieza de sangre laws come back to haunt you and you can never eradicate that drop of Jewish blood, what's to be said of Christian doctrine? So this is a very unusual and interesting take on what it actually means to be a converso in Christian Spain, to be a new Christian, if you can never really eradicate your former identity. There's also the echoes of that in that city in Spain that we discussed. The evidence of this type of Jew hatred was recently brought to light in a news feature when we learned that in 2015, a town that was originally named for killing Jews was in fact called Castrillo Mata Judios, Jew killer camp. And that was as late as 1627. There were records of this town in Spain being called by this name. In fact, by that point, there should have been no open Jews in Spain, right? It was 1627. And yet this city, this little town, had this name called Jew Killer Camp, and it retained that name until as late as 2015. So the Jew hatred was alive and well for many, many years, and it didn't go away just because Jews had Christianized. And I think it's also fascinating to mention here that the places that had forcibly eradicated the Jews, it's very interesting that they no longer bear a Jewish presence at all. Miriam's about to embark on her yearly destination, her yearly trip to Spain, her heritage trip. And we had discussed that there are absolutely no vestiges of Jewish life that are still vibrant today in Spain. So I think that that's something that has a parallel in Poland. Perhaps the lands that expelled their Jews with such brutality no longer merit a Jewish presence. And we shouldn't take for granted that the places in the Gullus, in the exile, that do have Jews have a certain and a special chen, or a certain special charm to them, that Hashem allows Jewish life to thrive and to survive and to flourish in places like the United States. Because that's not the case for every place in Europe. By logic, we should imagine that by now Spain should be repopulated with Jewish people, or Poland should be repopulated with a real Jewish presence. And yet that hasn't happened.
That's a fascinating observation. On that note, in a very sad and tragic way, you say that there is no living presence really of Jewish life. There is, you know, small communities here and there, but you're right, nothing that ever matched the flourishing of Jewish life before the expulsion. But there is, and this is so sad and tragic, there is a DNA study that tells you about a Jewish presence much muted in Spain. And this brings us back to our discussion of the conversion of Jews. And this subject is also rather controversial. When the Jews were given a choice to convert or leave, we now know the number suggests that at least half and possibly more than half of the Jews of Spain converted, which is really a shocking statistic. And the question is why? We're not talking about a community that wasn't religious. We're not talking about a community. We're talking about Jews who were observant Jews. Why is it? And that could be a subject of a whole other podcast. There are many reasons given. But what we do know today is that DNA studies were done that show that one out of every five Spanish men today in Spain carry genetic markers of Jewish ancestors, which means that the number of Jews who convert and stay behind, ultimately assimilating to Spanish society, is very high. And I think that's one of the tragic...
What was that statistic again?
One out of five. 20% of all Spanish men have Jewish DNA. What does that tell you? There's an ancestor way back when who was one of the conversos, one of the converts to Christianity. And of course, by now they're not Jewish, but their DNA bears traces of Jewish history. And if you think about the numbers and that 20%, and you think about if they had remained Jewish, what the numbers of Jews in the world would look like. It's quite astonishing.
It's mind-blowing. It's so sad. It's so upsetting. And I wonder about, again, I'm drawing the parallel to modern-day Poland, but about all the Jews who come out of the woodwork who Their DNA is not sublimated by non-Jewish blood. They're actually Jewish, but they never get to learn about it because their parents want to hide their Jewish ancestry from them growing up in the wake of the Holocaust.
Right.
And so many of them don't ever learn about it. Mm-hmm. So, but this is so many years later, and there's still traces of Jewish presence that is not at all Jewish because they don't even, you know, kind of they don't live as Jews and they don't know about it. It's so tragic to think that way. But our story takes us to a time when Jewish Spain and Jewish Portugal was a vibrant, living thing. The story of the Jews of Portugal is actually fascinating because in 1492, those Jews who did not want to convert and left, and we would include Dona Gracia's family among those families, most of them went to the country that offered them refuge if they could afford to pay a certain amount of taxes, and that would be Portugal. Portugal is the closest country, similar culture, similar language. And Dona Gracia's family ends up in Portugal. And things seem for a few years to be okay until we get to the year 1497. When the king, we have a shidduch issue here, because King Manuel of Portugal comes to the throne in 1495. He, after a brief period of persecution, the Jews of Portugal restores their freedom. He appreciates, this is so important for our entire discussion, the economic advantages that Jews bring to the country. But then he wants to get married, and he wants to get married to the daughter, Ferdinand Isabella. And the problem is they're so excited about this shidduch because we can unite Portugal and Spain, but there's a problem, and they send him a message. You have Jews in your kingdom. We got rid of ours. How can you be a good Catholic monarch and be married to our daughter with Jews in your kingdom? And now Manuel's faced with a problem. He likes the Jews. He likes their money, their expertise, their advice. How can he keep them and yet make his prospective in-laws happy? This tells us so much about political intrigue.
Yes.
And how marriages are often tied to the fates of nations.
Yeah.
The fate of nations are tied up in the marriages of the aristocracy. And how a family's fortune and a family's marriage and wedding arrangement can actually affect the future of the Jews. And it also tells us how the Inquisition was different from country to country, and not every country was affected in the same way or at the same time. And the Portuguese experience differed from the Spanish experience in this way.
Right. So Manuel gives the Jews the same choice that they were offered in Spain. And in 1497, the Jews are given a date at which they can either appear at the port of Lisbon with their bags packed and leave or remain. And we have to remember something. This is important. The Jews in Portugal, those Jews who had left Spain because they wanted to remain Jewish, none of them want to accept the offer to convert and stay. So all of them essentially pack their bags and get ready to leave. But instead of allowing the ships to take them out of the harbor, there are no ships. Instead, all the Jews are forcibly baptized right then and there. And that means that you now have an entire community of conversos. Here we're not questioning the Jewishness or the loyalty to Judaism, because these are the Jews who were loyal to Judaism and who had left Spain originally to stay Jewish. So you now have thousands of Portuguese Jews living as conversos.
We can point to the fact that this was such a tragic turn of events because this was not a voluntary conversion. This was a bait and switch of the highest order where all these Portuguese Jews are suddenly tragically baptized against their will. And we can finally think about our heroine, Doña Gracia Luna Mendez Nasi. She was a woman born into a family of proud Jews who were forced to flee during this upheaval from Spain to Portugal. And this woman of Luna of Light is born in Anusa. She's born into this family of secret Jews. The wealth of her family, which has been debated in historical sources, is less apparent than the wealth of her rich uncle, who then becomes her husband, Francisco Mendez, also known as Tzemach Benaveniste. He's a religious man, much more than Gracia, who was probably apprised of her Jewish identity only at age 12, like other secret Jews. But Francisco was rabbi of the Anusim. And when she marries him, they in fact have two wedding ceremonies, one recognized as Catholic, Portuguese by the officials, and the other one in a private chuppah, most probably in her own home.
Tzipori, you mentioned something fascinating, which is that Dona Gracia married her uncle, which, again, for the modern listener, might sound very bizarre or strange. But please note that in the medieval period, well into the modern period, wealthy families, especially converso families, wanted to retain their wealth, are suspicious of outsiders, and remaining endogamous and marrying within the family is a way to preserve your wealth. It's a way to make sure that outsiders are not coming in and challenging your secret Jewish status. And so this was very, very common and not unusual at all. You married cousins, you married uncles, very common practices amongst converso families,
as well as marrying in terms of fusing wealth of families, because I think an underlying theme throughout today's podcast episode is shidduchim. We spoke about shidduchim writ large in the aristocracy, but now in the converso aristocracy as well, we're talking about a shidduch made according to wealth and lineage. And in fact, in that sense, Gracia marries up because she marries this very religious man who's also a very wealthy man. So interestingly mentioned, her family will once again marry into this family, which complicates things even more. But commercially, Portugal was the most important gateway to Europe because all of the exotic merchandise, black pepper, which was called black gold, right, and other spices, tobacco, wood, metals, precious stones, they all arrived in Lisbon. And all the trade that benefited the Portuguese crown was managed from start to finish by the Mendes brothers. This lasted for approximately 30 years. This is now Gracia's legacy. This is now Gracia's money, right? Because soon her husband dies. And this is just after such a short period of marriage. And they have a baby, they have Reina, this one little girl, and then he leaves half of his wealth to Dona Gracia. And in very interesting circumstances, which we'll discuss shortly, according to Catholic law, a widow inherits half of his money, and he has a will as well in which he names Gracia as executrix. We'll discuss that a little bit later. But Gracia then moves to Antwerp, to Flanders, it was called then, together with her brother-in-law, Diego Mendes. And together they grow their commercial interests. Then the next shidduch happens. Diego marries Gracia's sister, Brianda. And then Diego passes away after only 4 years of marriage, and their little daughter also, that is interestingly called after her aunt. She's called Gracia, just to confuse our listeners. Exactly, just a little bit. So we gave her a nickname, right? We didn't give it to her. They give her a nickname, perhaps, for that reason.
La Chica.
La Chica, exactly, the little girl. And he, too, leaves half of his wealth, not to his wife, but to his sister-in-law, Gracia, naming her the executrix. And he appoints her as manager of all of the Benavisti family's wealth and property. Now, this is something that's well-documented in the rabbinical sources from the time and will really unfold not during their life in Antwerp, but much later during their time when they settle in Constantinople, where it's brought down in the Jewish sources. It would be interesting to hear about the role of women during this period of time, what their economic reach could be, and how they could be players inside and outside their home at this period of history.
So I think it's important to note that Dona Gracia was only 25 years old when her husband died, and it's incredible that her husband recognized her business expertise, if you will, or potential business expertise by placing her as an inheritor to his wealth. Should also point out just how wealthy they were. You mentioned that they basically controlled much of the trade that came into Lisbon. Francisco and his brother Diogo were so wealthy that they created the second wealthiest or largest bank in all of Europe during their lifetime. And this is the inheritance of Dona Gracia. She's 25 years old. At 25 years old, they really knew how to balance a checkbook. And here she is running this multinational. And I think it is important to note, and I think for our listeners especially who are, you know, interested in this question of what women did, and the answer is that throughout Jewish history, and certainly throughout the medieval period, we see women engage in all kinds of business activities. Nobody reaches the level that Dona Gracia reaches, this mogul.
Right.
But certainly you have women who are moneylenders. You have women who are traders. You have women buying and selling all kinds of things. You have women in the Muslim world who are acting as agents for Muslim women who are not allowed to publicly buy or sell things. You have women in the Italian Renaissance who are making buttons and selling silk and are moneylenders and traders and craftswomen and doing all sorts of things. So it's interesting that women are not limited, and halakha doesn't limit or relegate women to a strictly domestic role. And throughout Jewish history, you know, the song, Eishes Chayil, that we sing every week about women bringing in merchandise for the ships, that's not just a metaphor. It's actually a reality. Women throughout Jewish history, and certainly in the early Renaissance period in Italy, especially, you have women engaged in all sorts of activities. Dona Gracia, I think, is distinguished by the scale of her activities, but not by the fact that she is a businesswoman. Since we mentioned Italy, it's fascinating that in Italy, Renaissance Italy, there were even examples of Jewish women who, I don't know what the feminine version of this, they were mohels, mohalot, would it be?
Yes.
So you have women doing all sorts of interesting things, and their activities are not limited in any real sense. And they do contribute. There are many women who contributed to the economic, you know, health of their families and whose contributions were crucial to keeping the family afloat.
And particular to the Italian Renaissance, which I didn't even realize we would mention today, but there are also mentions in rabbinical sources of women learning Torah and allusions to the formal learning of women who sought to learn and to transmit Torah learning. We have that in the writings of Rabbi Shmuel Arkivolti in Mayan Ganim, a poem really written about a woman who was asking to learn Torah. So all across the board, we have women doing fascinating things. All across the board, we have women engaged in what we might consider today to be surprising endeavors.
English.
In the sources that speak about Dona Gracia, we don't have awe or surprise at her reach.
Yes.
And that's, I think, also very fascinating that no one is saying, we've never had a woman like this. And definitely she had to have been one of the most influential women of all time, as we mentioned. But the fact that she's in business and running so much of this empire and being empowered to do so by the men in her life, first her husband and then her brother-in-law, points in fact to the non-surprising nature of women's power and reach at the time.
And I would add to that that the rabbis at the time acknowledged that and gave her tremendous respect and honor in all their correspondence with her. And there was never a sense, as you put, like, oh, women? No.
And she's mentioned by name.
And with honorifics.
Great adulation, as well for Ratzrana, by so many of the rabbanim, whose yeshivos she supported, whose Torahs she printed, as we'll speak about later in the Ferrara Bible. So she definitely used her wealth for the right reasons in terms of Torah learning, and as we'll also see in terms of the bricha endeavors, the support system that she created, the pidyon shvuyim that she did, the smuggling of people from dangerous positions, whether it's inside Christian-dominated areas who wanted to escape to other places. This was a woman who was at the forefront of all of this change while maintaining a full schedule of, as you called her, international mogul status.
Tzipora, you mentioned that the first stop, once it became too dangerous to live in Portugal, we should mention that the Inquisition did come to Portugal in the 16th century. And so the Jews of Portugal now began to escape in increasingly large numbers. You could not stay any longer in Portugal and hope to maintain your status as a secret Jew now that the Inquisition on your tail. So they're going to move to Flanders and spend time in Antwerp. But there's a question that we might have, which is, since Dona Gracia is going to Antwerp, which is ruled by the Catholics, it's a Catholic kingdom, why is she going from the frying pan into the fire? And the answer is that as a major businesswoman, Antwerp, Flanders, was the commercial center for Europe at the time. And even though it was still dangerous, it's important to note that they used bribes to stay out of trouble from the Inquisition. She is amazing because she begins to use her resources while living in a Catholic country. She designed an entire underground network that helped hundreds of secret Jews, crypto Jews, leave Spain and Portugal. She had ships, donkeys, horses, taking them all across Europe by ship to safe harbors to places in the Ottoman Empire. She even has refugees end up in Israel. She's going to support that. Refugees end up in Salonika. And she not only sees to it that the Jewish refugees are able to escape Portugal alive and reach the destination safely, she also prevents them from losing all their belongings.
Yes.
You know that the Inquisition, once you were found guilty of Judaizing, there's a financial incentive to find you guilty because then the state and the church can confiscate your wealth. So what did Dona Gracia do? She had a company that was set up to buy and sell the properties of these converso Jews before they could be confiscated by the Inquisition. And so the money from these proceedings were sent directly to the property's owner's hands through the Mendes Bank.
She cashes them out. She thinks about cashing them out and making sure they retain their financial viability.
And at the same time, she's also dealing with King Henry II of England, with Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, the King of France, and even with the popes. She's actually dealing with the enemy themselves and on, you know, million-dollar deals here, loans. And
this also presupposes she must have known so many languages. She must have had amazing communication skills in order to be in this position as well.
That's an interesting comment. Conversos were so valuable to the monarchs of Europe precisely because they're men of the world, and in this case, women of the world, who are familiar with the languages of Europe. They speak Castilian, they speak Spanish, they speak Portuguese. They can easily converse. They also, you have to remember, if you're a converso, you don't look or appear Jewish. You're dressed in the garb of the Christians.
Right.
You can easily pass, so to speak. And so very often it's in the interest of even popes, who you would think would come down hard against the conversos, to ignore what might be secret Jewish leanings or beliefs because they're so valuable to your economies. In fact, you're crucial. The conversos were crucial to the economies of Europe.
So not only because of their cosmopolitan qualities, but also because of their networks and wealth and reach.
International connections, absolutely. A Jew in Portugal could have a relative in the Ottoman Empire, could have traders in the New World. And all of them are connected by this Jewish 3 degrees of separation or 1 degree of separation.
Interesting how that remains a thread throughout the generations with the Rothschilds, right? And later on with more modern Jewish families that we think about, that networking, that even when Jews are not related, but the lingua franca between Jews, we see that later in Aleppo and in the traders who passed through the Francos, right, who passed through Styria, that the international trade network between Jews is a solid bond that is never doubted and never contested. There is this ne'emanus between Jewish people that is really has worked in our favor for so, so many generations. Meanwhile, Gracia leaves Antwerp to go to Venice because of a different kind of shidduch crisis. Her daughter, Reina, catches the eye of the Christian aristocracy, and she is sought after. And this is threatening to Gracia because, for all the reasons we mentioned, she's closely networked into the Christian aristocracy and probably linked in business and in all kinds of connections. And she doesn't feel she has the wherewithal to refuse this. So she picks up and leaves, and she actually goes to Venice, to Italy.
I just want to add that if, in fact, her daughter were to marry a old Christian, her wealth would then be transferred to her husband. So there's yet another danger here, that if, God forbid, her daughter were to marry an old Christian, the wealth that she is an inheritor to would disappear and would then be taken over by her Christian husband. It's reported, I don't know if this is documented, but it's been reported that when one of the emperors of Europe, maybe it was Charles V, had sought her daughter Anna, later known as Reina's hand, for one of his children, perhaps, Donna Gracia replied with, "I would rather see her drowned than married to a Christian." And that tells you something about Donna Gracia's loyalty to Judaism. And certainly there was a real danger here of not only losing her fortune, but losing her daughter to the Christian world. And so, yes, she had to pick up and go to Venice.
In the interest of retaining her Jewish identity, apparently even all of her power and her wealth couldn't protect her. And she still felt vulnerable enough. This woman, this impermeable woman, right? Impenetrable. She still felt that she had to pick up and leave, which does tell you a lot about, even within all this power, ultimately as a Jew, she's powerless. She can't stay there. She has to go.
Right. In Venice as well, she does not revert to an open Jewish lifestyle. We know, for example, that Venice was an important commercial center and the city was an independent republic, recognized the contributions of Jewish businessmen, and many, many Jews lived in Venice, and Ashkenaz Jews and native Italian Jews, but they had to live in the ghetto. When she gets to Venice, she doesn't live in the ghetto. And that suggests that she's not living as if she has not reverted back to Judaism. She is living in sort of this gray area as a new Christian, while everyone knows that she feels deeply connected to the Jewish people.
I wonder if it's because being privileged today to visit that ghetto, which is basically intact, the Ghetto Nuovo of Venice, was there a house big enough for Donna Gracia there? We know that wherever she went, she lived in these beautiful mansions, but it said about her that there were always at least 80 people, 80 poor people sitting at her table.
At her house in Constantinople.
Mm-hmm. In her own table, right? Benefiting from her tzedakah. So I wonder if that was a constant. We know about it in Constantinople, but
absolutely.
Yeah, it was at a constant wherever she went. And in the ghetto life, where would she put them? There was no gam-gam in those days, right? Where would she put them?
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because today when you visit Venice, it's like the ghetto in Venice is like this, the hottest neighborhood in Venice. And it's funky and it's beautiful and the buildings are well preserved. But back then it was dirty and crowded. And certainly if you were a multimillionaire, powerful woman, you would not want to live in the ghetto, nor would you want to be forced to wear the distinguishing signs of clothing that Jews had to wear in the ghettos of Europe. So she was exempt from that and moved to a wealthy neighborhood of non-Jews because she is technically still a non-Jew.
Meanwhile, Gracia leaves Venice. Yet again, and this time it's because of a dispute that breaks out between herself, Brianda, and Gracia. And this has to do with the inheritance that we mentioned earlier, that her own husband referenced Gracia as executrix of half of his fortune. And this is something that's of grave offense to Brianda. In fact, she is known as more of a lighthearted, frivolous type of person, and that's how most of the historical literature paints her, even though today's history digs a little deeper and tries to claim that perhaps it wasn't exactly as black and white as all of that. But the fact that her own husband preferences a sister-in-law rather than his wife as executrix of the will does suggest that there were some deficiencies in her character, and is suggested here that Brianda, in fact, tries to out Gracia as a converso, as a person who's still holding on to her Jewish identity, which is something that's obviously true. But because she was so miffed and upset about not inheriting, she brings this before the court.
That you have two sisters here fighting each other, and that you have Brianda outing her sister as an open Jew is astonishing, because it means that she's endangering her sister's life and her sister's fortune. When I read details of the court case, the many court cases brought by each sister against the other, it reminded me, and I hope I don't sound frivolous, of some of the family first serials that always sound so over the top and family feuds. But at the end of the day, especially when large sums of money are involved, I think that's something that modern day readers of this history can relate to. Money can poison family relations, and you really see this here. We're talking about enormous sums. And you're also talking about the interest of the Christian governments, who see an opportunity to lay their hands on the Mendes fortune. And so all of them have a stake in this battle. And that is why, by bringing this court case to the Venetian authorities, Brianda knows she's going to find a sympathetic ear. And in fact, the Venetian authorities rule against Donna Gracia. But by then, Donna Gracia has already moved to Ferrara and now starts a whole new chapter in her life, because Ferrara is a very different place than Venice.
And it's amazing that Donna Gracia was able to have the foresight to turn to the Duke of Ferrara, who in 1549 recognizes the validity of the Diego inheritance and gives shelter to the family in his city. And that's what enabled her move. So different than the family first serials, which are not resolved by turning to dukes and duchesses, Gracia is able to turn around and tap into her aristocratic connections and find succor and help in other countries. And while in Ferrara, she uses her power and fortune to protect crypto-Jews and to redeem prisoners. And she was involved, as we mentioned, in that initial iteration of organized smuggling of Jews from place to place, the persecution to places of freedom. And so what happens is that Donna Gracia uses her wealth connections and her cunning to save people's lives. She contributed to the publication of the Bible translation into Ladino, which was called the Ferrara Bible, and written testimonies from her contemporaries like Shmuel Oshki and Yosef HaKohen and others, and Hakdamos, prefaces that Rabbanim of the time wrote to her, attest to this amazing power. In thinking about Donna Gracia's focus on books and her support of publishing houses like the ones owned by Avraham Ushke and Yom Tov Atzias over other endeavors such as art, she chose to support the Jewish book. It makes us think about women who were always involved in the printing and dissemination of Jewish books, and I think it points to the love women always had for books and the idea that women wanted to be a part of the transmission of the printed word. And we might think about it rooted in the pasuk that we all know so well, Shema b'ni Musar Avicha, the Musar, the admonition of the fathers, was transmitted orally, just as Torah Shebaal Peh is transmitted orally from father to son. And women are kind of excluded from that transmission. But Va'al Titosh Torah Simecha, the written Torah, that gets transmitted through the mothers, through the women. And women would in fact hold the Torah Shebichsav, they would hold Chumashim, and they would gift these books to their daughters as wedding presents. And also women understood that books as portable goods didn't have to be left behind when they got married, when your family had to move abruptly from place to place, as was often the case for Jewish people. There's a beautiful story ascribed by Andre Alian Brooks in her famous book about Doña Gracia, the woman who defied kings. And she ascribes it to Judith Baskin, although I didn't find it in the source she cites. But it tells of a woman in the 13th century whose husband gave her a piece of gold to purchase a new dress, and she informs him she'd rather buy a book or hire a scribe to write a new text to lend to her students, right? It's beautiful. We can relate to that.
Really beautiful.
In any case, Ferrara establishes Doña Gracia's position as a supporter of Sifrei Kodesh and Torah learning.
But I would add to that, there's a practical reason why Doña Gracia, in addition to this beautiful Al Titosh Torat Yimecha and the love of Jewish women that we've had for books, there's this idea that Dona Gracia recognizes that for the thousands of conversos who have been living for so long as Christian, they no longer know Hebrew. And there's a desperate need to translate both the Bible and also the Siddur. She has a Siddur printed by Rav Yom Tov Atias, which is a translation into Ladino so that the Jews can have access to the holy sources that they have not had access to because they're illiterate in Hebrew, which is really, if you think about it, so tragic.
I think that might have been the case for Doña Gracia herself as well,
yes.
Who seems to have been literate in so many languages, but not Hebrew. So perhaps she was also printing that for her own sake, not only for the sake of everyone else, so that she could be more learned. But that's just conjecture. It might not, in fact, be the case. But feeling the need, as she did, to produce these books and being able to produce them is such a wonderful endeavor for her to have chosen.
Right. And the translation of the Bible that you mentioned is also important because there were earlier translations of the Bible into the languages, you know, Castilian, Spanish, etc. But remember that those translations were Christological and perverted the original Hebrew meaning. So it was so important for the conversos who were all familiar. They had been forced to go to church. They were all familiar with the Christian versions of the Bible, but to have an authentic Bible, to have an authentic Bible that represented Jewish tradition and Jewish parshanut, that was a sort of revolution in Jewish literature for the conversos.
And so amazing that a woman was the one who was behind all of that.
Patroness of Jewish arts,
of
the Jewish arts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of Torah.
Writ large.
Mm-hmm.
This leads us right into her final destination when she moves to Constantinople. And the significance of this move for her and how the legacy is solidified through her move there is an important chapter that we can't stress enough. This is where it all comes together.
Yes, I think the chapter of Dona Gracia's life in Constantinople is when she reaches the very pinnacle of her actions on behalf of the Jewish people. And really, there's no other way to put it. This woman is a tzaddikus. What she does in Constantinople is extraordinary.
Thank you for listening to Veiled Reference. Enjoy this episode and share it with your friends. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear from you at podcasts@mishpacha.com. Veiled Reference, a Mishpacha podcast.